Don't look now, but this is going to be an economic week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, everybody, the 26th of April. Good as always to have you along. This is, as I said, going to be a big week in the life of the American economy. The Fed meets tomorrow and Wednesday. Might be some news there. Yes, no, I know they are not going to do anything on rates. There was the census news today. Sure, yes, that's political on the face of it. But believe me when I tell you it is really about the money. And then, oh yeah, there's a big speech to a joint session of Congress coming Wednesday from the new-ish guy in the White House. With Friday marking his first 100 days, President Biden's going to roll out the next part of his agenda, the American Families Plan, it's called. And like everything else the Biden White House wants to do, this administration is asking people to look a little bit differently at what needs to go into the economy to get robust and equitable outcomes. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us started.
One of the key things we're hearing about the American Families Plan is that it calls for major additional investments for kids, pre-kindergarten, more child care support, all part of the Biden administration's argument that these things are necessary for a well-functioning economy, especially given what the pandemic revealed, says Cindy Cisneros, Vice President for Education Programs at the Committee for Economic Development.
I think there was a greater recognition for employers in the business community that childcare is really the workforce that supports all other workforces.
This isn't a new idea, but there's a lot more support for it than in the past, says Stu Friedman, a professor emeritus at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania.
The pandemic had a huge role in reshaping how American parents think about the needs that they have from government to help educate and take care of their kids so that they can work.
For many parents, this was no secret. But now, even more people recognize how hard it is to juggle remote learning or other child care duties while trying to work. But whose job should it be to help? The private sector? States? Extended family? Veronique DeRuggi is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute.
I think fundamentally what has changed is that the pandemic has actually opened a door and given an opportunity for Democrats to make the case that this is a role for the federal government.
A case many Republicans and some Democrats dispute vigorously. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Speaking of infrastructure spending, as we were just then, we did a story last week about small businesses doing a bunch more CapEx, that is capital expenditures, to improve their own business infrastructure. Today, some evidence that it's not just small businesses. Apple says it's going to spend $430 billion and add 20,000 jobs in the United States over the next 5 years. And more than a billion of that is going to go into building a whole new campus and engineering hub in North Carolina. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Apple's identity, historically, has been very wrapped up in its hardware, Macs and iPhones. But this decision to spend $1 billion on a big new campus in the Research Triangle,
this is not a hardware investment.
Andy Wu is a professor at Harvard Business School.
For Apple's next generation of technology, particularly in software, they need access to a very high-skilled labor pool, particularly in the areas of machine learning and artificial intelligence, which is plentiful in North Carolina,
where there are three major universities, a bunch of other tech companies, and where it costs less to live than it does in Silicon Valley or New York. Add it all up, Wu says.
Being in North Carolina will allow it to attract a more diverse labor pool than it's historically been able to.
Affordability, increasingly, is a big draw for workers and employers, says Victor Bennett at Duke's Fuqua School of Business.
Places like New York and DC, they're so expensive to live in right now that they're becoming more and more difficult to hire people in.
Apple's decision to invest in a new campus in a new state seems to indicate that the company sees a role for the office post-pandemic, says Scott Kessler, an analyst at Third Bridge.
Really, what they're signaling more than anything else is that there are tremendous benefits from having offices where smart people can congregate and they can collaborate and they can really innovate in a way that will be better.
Apple had been in talks with North Carolina back in 2018. Later that year, the company announced plans to develop a new campus in Austin, Texas. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
One more spending item before we move on. We learned this morning orders for durable goods, that's big, expensive stuff meant to last 3 years or more. Those orders had a nice bump last month. Not as nice as everybody had been guessing, but nice, you know. On Wall Street today, also nice. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Online shopping, as we all know, has been having quite a year this past year. But online ain't all that for all businesses. Back in 2018, we took a trip out to Secaucus, New Jersey, to visit the high-end resale marketplace, The Real Real. One of their warehouses is out there. And in the pandemic, they have taken a slightly different tack, investing in brick and mortar, small neighborhood stores in places like Palo Alto and Brooklyn and Dallas, among others. Julie Wainwright is the founder and CEO of The Real Real. We got her back on the phone the other day, and I asked her the standard first question when catching up with a business owner on this program. How is business?
Well, I'm happy to say it looks pretty good right now. Our business started picking up again in December, and it's just increased. So I'm feeling very optimistic.
Why do you think, other than the general economy improving, right? I mean, you guys did not do so badly during the pandemic, and I wonder why you think that is.
Actually, we did have a hard time. Let me just give you some stats. Oh, yeah, it was pretty hard for us. So prior to the pandemic close downs, we were up about 40% versus year ago. So we ended up in April, for example, being down 45%. Hmm. So we had an 85% swing on our business overnight, and we had to furlough or lay off over 1,000 of the 3,000 employees. What we're seeing is as the cities open up, our business is returning to normal faster than we anticipated. So right now, we're up almost three times versus year ago.
How do you handle? So look, that's a good problem to have, right? Being up three times. But how do you handle swings like that? It must make you, as the boss, lose a whole lot of sleep.
You know, honestly, this growth is what we were built for. And I think you got a little taste of that when we were together in 2018 in our Secaucus warehouse. Yeah. But then we had 9 million members on our site. Now we have 21 million. So we're more built for growth, and it feels good, and everyone's pretty excited.
You were saying, before we turn on the microphones, you had just come across the picture of us together in late 2018, and you said, it's amazing how we've changed. Tell me how you've changed, because we walked through that warehouse, and you had validators and verifiers, and you had shipping people, and it was a pretty streamlined operation. How have you changed things?
We still have that, but now we just are opening our 700,000 square foot facility in Phoenix, and the one you were in was 110,000. Now we've automated a lot. So what has changed is we've been using machine learning and AI to automate some of the features. So pricing is first set for about 90% of our products by machines, and then human overview. So it has gotten more automated, but I think in general, the business has scaled pretty excitingly.
Well, but wait, let me ask you about that, because, you know, being built for growth and opening a 700,000 square foot facility carries with it some risk. And I imagine you, as the person making these decisions, you have to be pretty confident in your growth projections to be doing that, especially at a time like this.
I think, you know, in general, our business was growing before the pandemic. There's absolutely nothing systemic that would change that as people get more vaccinated and things open up. That combined with long lines outside our stores to consign or buy, which are just accelerating, gives me a lot of great indication.
Can we talk actually stores for a second, as opposed to the big warehouse sort of distribution centers that you guys run? You're opening more of them, and I want to know why you're investing in brick and mortar.
We are opening more. So since you and I talked, we've opened 11, and we're going to probably have about 13 by the end of July. Hmm. And what we find is people that actually shop both in the store and online spend about 3 times as much. We sell higher value things when people can touch it and ask questions. Now, it's counterintuitive because retail is pretty decimated, especially the smaller stores, but it makes sense for our business. And we've seen a lot of people excited to get out and shop again. I think we're going to see a nice resurgence for everyone that has the capital to open retail stores again.
You know, it strikes me that what you are describing to me about your business and how it's popped, it's literally the manifestation of pent-up demand, right? We've been talking about pent-up demand in this economy since, I don't know, January-ish. And you're it right now, right? People are, they want nice things. They want the things that you sell and they want to go out and get them.
You know, without a doubt. And the apparel is starting to pick up, which was a key leading indicator for us. Look, you know, we're public now. We weren't public when we first met. And we kept telling our investors, we're not a pandemic friendly business because we have to go into people's homes. We have people that have to touch things in the op centers. But we believe we're going to be a pandemic recovery story. And, you know, early days, but it certainly looks that way.
Julie Wainwright, she's the founder, also the CEO of The Real Real. Julie, thanks a lot. I appreciate you taking the time.
Great to talk to you, Ty.
This past year has been mostly a year without live music, which means everybody involved, musicians, venues, sound engineers, roadies, everybody took a hit. Slowly but surely, though, with vaccinations taking hold, it is coming back. Concerts are popping up. And while it's not going to look the same, it's a welcome comeback, as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
In retrospect, Bad Bunny's 2020 smash hit song, Yo Perreo Sola, or I Dance By Myself, was kind of an omen. After all, many of us spent the last year doing a lot of things by ourselves, including attending concerts on virtual platforms. But with a growing number of Americans getting vaccinated, live music might be slowly coming back. When pre-sale tickets for Bad Bunny's 2022 tour went online a few weeks ago, they set the record for the fastest-selling tour on Ticketmaster since 2018. This summer, what a live concert will look like will be different. In New York City, for example, large arenas like Madison Square Garden can only reopen at 10% capacity and will be requiring proof of vaccination or of a recent negative COVID test. In smaller indoor venues, it gets even trickier. Singer Sofia Rey will be performing in front of a 50-person audience in Brooklyn in June.
We were told that we would have to wear a veil to perform, because for singing, there is more risk of transmission of COVID because of droplets.
Limited capacity also means higher ticket prices, and not all musicians are jumping at the opportunity to get out there. Damon Krukowski from the duo Damon and Naomi.
I personally feel it's too soon. I don't think we know the real health risks involved.
At least for this summer, you'll get to pick between some live music shows or dancing in front of a screen, if you so please. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow morning, if you're up, the Marketplace Morning Report, David Brancaccio and the gang telling you everything you need to know to start your business day. Coming up.
They've got a full bed. They've got curtains. They've got lights. They've got a cold beer in the fridge.
I mean, okay. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 61 points today, about a 10%, 33,981. The NASDAQ boosted 121 points higher, 0.8%, 14,138. The S&P 500 up 7 points, about a 10%, 41.87 there. As Smith Fields was telling us, Apple is planting a seed in North Carolina. Get it? Apple seed? That was pretty good. With the announcement, it plans to build a new billion-dollar campus in and around Raleigh. Apple picked up more than 0.25% today. And peeling off a little more on Apple, the company launched its new privacy feature that allows iPhone and iPad users to opt out of tracking by third parties like Facebook. The social media giant, though, still rose 0.6%. I have to tell you, I downloaded it. Can't find that feature anywhere inside the iOS. Maybe that's just me. Bond prices unchanged. Yield on the 10-year T-note probably is just me. Ended at 1.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have heard a lot the past 13 or 14 months about shortages of medical staff, doctors in particular. It's a long road to that medical degree, 4 years of med school, and then something like 3 to 7 more years in a residency program. The catch is that every year there are medical students who don't find a spot in a residency. Matching, it's called. And this year, there were more than 42,000 applicants for just over 38,000 residencies. That's thousands, at least, of would-be doctors who don't initially match. By some estimates, there are even more than that. And without a residency, you can't really get a license to practice medicine. So then what do you do? Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
Every year in mid-March, matching videos show up on social media. These are medical students finding out where they're going to do their residencies and become practicing doctors.
I'm Ashley Duke!
Congratulations!
It's Ohio State!
You did it.
I'm Ashley Duke!
But not everybody has something to celebrate.
I was pretty hurt. I was like, is this even real?
Mahad Minhas didn't match last year, even after college, getting a master's in public health, and then attending medical school.
This is years and years and years of hard work, not just medical school, but everything, moving to different places, leaving your family behind, not being able to watch your siblings grow up and, you know, stuff like that. So I was just like, this is all for nothing. Like, all of this was for nothing.
Minhas wanted a urology residency, but so do lots of other people. So he switched to radiology and ended up with what's called a preliminary match in general surgery. That's an assignment for a year. The number of medical school slots and residencies just don't match, says Cambridge Health Alliance psychiatry resident Gabrielle Felix.
If we have a certain number of people graduating, particularly in this country, that they should be able to have the opportunity of a job.
While in medical school at Howard, Felix was the president of the Student National Medical Association and advocated for more residency positions. Many residencies are funded in full or in part by Medicare. The funding for more slots isn't there now, yet the need for doctors is increasing, says Janice Orlowski with the Association of American Medical Colleges.
In the next 10 years, there's going to be somewhere between 54,000 and 139,000 physicians that we are going to be short in the United States.
Orlowski herself matched in 1982 and says the process is not only more competitive now, it's more expensive. Mahad Minhas had $375,000 in student loans. He thought about leaving medicine altogether.
Why should I struggle so hard to be a part of this system that doesn't want me? And so I was just going to quit.
Or he could have gone to Missouri. The state allows unmatched med school grads to practice under the supervision of a physician. Jeff Howell is the vice president of the Missouri State Medical Association.
You know, like a lot of other places, we're facing a physician shortage, especially in rural areas. So the concept was we have medical students that are graduating, and rather than have them drive Ubers for a year before they can attempt to match again, allow them to have some clinical experience.
This year, Mahad Minhas went through the match again.
And somehow I got one at the program that I wanted to be at. So I wish I could go back and tell my younger self that hey, things are actually going to work out exactly how you want them to. You just don't know it yet.
In 2 months, he'll start his residency at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And at the end of it, he'll be an attending radiologist. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The Oscars were last night, of course, and despite some, well, shall we say, unexpected moments right at the end there, Nomadland did win a couple of the big categories, as predicted. It's a film, of course, about a woman driving throughout the West looking for work and living in her van. It is, quite literally, that movie, An Adventure in Housing, fitting neatly into our series, Adventures in Housing. Here you go.
My name is Ilsa Chapel. I am the owner of the Seattle Cascade Campers Build Shop in Seattle, Washington. The cost of a conversion is $8,000. Customers will, you know, drop off their van in the morning and they wave to this empty cargo bed of a van. And then they come back and they've got a full bed. They've got curtains. They've got lights. They've got a cold beer in the fridge. You know, the whole works, basically everything that you need in a camper van. Normally, we complete a van in 2 days in our Seattle shop, but we have definitely experienced some delays in shipping. It's as if the beginning of COVID is happening again in terms of supply chain. Batteries and fridges are always the two main items that are hard to get. We've even had a harder time getting foam and upholstery. I would say that older retired single women have been probably our largest demographic. Perhaps a partner has passed or, you know, a divorce has happened and they're on their own for the first time in a long time. And I've just heard a lot of stories from customers of now is my time to make the decisions for myself. And, you know, I didn't get to do that a lot of my life. It surprises people when they hear that women are maybe our main demographic. But I mean, if you think about it, it's a really safe way to get out into nature and explore. And I like that I can lock myself into my little tin box at night and nothing's going to get me. Whereas, you know, if you're out in a tent, you're also closer to a lot of elements that could pose threats. I just finished a customer's van named Sharon. You know, she's incredibly intelligent, educated woman from Eastern Washington. And she told me she was 79 years old and I could not believe it. Absolutely better shape than I am for sure. She brought me her van and she also brought me a package and I opened it and it was this framed photo of a bald eagle and this eagle is named Harriet. Sharon has been watching Harriet for 12 years, this same bald eagle, and she believes Harriet to be a strong, independent bald eagle. And when she found out that it was just me building her van, she thought that it was incredibly cool that a woman was going to be building out her camper van. And so she brought me a picture of Harriet as a little reminder that I'm also a strong, independent woman. And so Harriet is going to be sitting above my office watching me now.
Ilsa Chapel there. She builds camper vans at Cascade Campers up in Seattle. Hey, do us a favor, would you? Tell us about your adventure in housing. You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which, yet again, a corporate rebranding goes horribly wrong. There's an asset management company over in the UK that, until this morning, was called Standard Life Aberdeen. Somehow, the people in charge decided that was no good anymore, that name, and so have rebranded. Henceforth, the company shall be known as Aberdeen. Seriously, it's just A-B-R-D-N. Aberdeen. Said CEO Stephen Bird, our new brand, Aberdeen, builds our heritage and is modern, dynamic, and most importantly, engaging. I mean, it's like me saying this is Marketplace, right? Not even, just Marketplace. Anyway, we're leaving. Here's your moment of economic context. You will hear this elsewhere in the news today, I am sure, but I just want to make another quick pass at the census numbers out today. 331,449,281 people lived in the United States as of last April the 1st. That is a growth rate of 7.4% over the past decade, the slowest since the Great Depression. So why am I mentioning it if it's going to be everywhere in the news? Because really, politics aside, population is a labor market story. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham. Welcome, Richard. Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody, on this radio show, which henceforth shall be known as Merkin Police. Come on, man. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.